Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland, filling in today for Lori Walsh. And the legal showdown over President Trump's immigration executive order continues. Today, we're going to talk about what the order really means in South Dakota. And Paul Turman is Vice President for Academic Affairs for the South Dakota Board of Regents. He joins us now to discuss the impact on state universities. Paul, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Kara.
So let's start. 32 people from South Dakota State Universities are affected by this immigration action. Is that true?
That's correct. It's actually 32. We had 32 employees of one kind or another.
Okay.
So we had four faculty. We had about another 20 students who are graduate teaching assistants or graduate research assistants. And then the remainder were student employees, so they most likely are undergraduate students who are employed in either maybe dining services within facilities in some way at the institution. But all together on the student side, we had roughly about 70 students that are coming from these affected countries.
And these are students, let's start with the students. These are students who are here in an exchange program, or is there a mixture of what type of students these are?
It could be, it is certainly a mixture. So for those that are familiar with exchange programs, really the way in which those work is that our institutions enter into an agreement with another university in that host country. So whether that be from, say, Iran or even Great Britain or France, they certainly engage in a process of they're taking our students and we're exchanging our students on behalf of getting students from their country to kind of experience a different kind of perspective of higher education while they're finishing their degrees. We also have a sizable number of students who come to the regional system each year, and they are international students, but they are degree-seeking, so they have left their country and have chosen to apply and be admitted and gone through the necessary paperwork to get the appropriate visas to enter the country and then be a student with the goal of finishing a degree in the United States.
And when you heard of the executive order, what types of things had to happen and fall into place? I mean, where did your brain take you when you heard the executive order?
I think right away what we were concerned about was, do we have any staff or students who may be traveling at the time? Because certainly we saw that it was reentry was probably the biggest thing that was going to impact them. So had they been out of country, gone back for a funeral or to see family for any other reason, then those students would have been barred from being able to come back. And so our international offices really began to kind of look at, where are our students right now, and do we know of any that have left the country? Unfortunately, we did not. I think the second thing that began to kind of unfold was, so what really becomes kind of the long-term implications for this? It's spelled out as really just a 90-day executive order, but those can be extended. And so what happens when a student or a staff member wanted to travel, say, over spring break? Do they need to change those plans? And just getting out information about what we did know about it to those affected students were the things that, you know, in the hours that transpired going through the weekend, that a lot of our staff really were trying to get a good sense about what this all meant and how do we inform those affected students as best we can.
And what then does this do for recruiting and maintaining an international student body in the years to come?
You know, I think we certainly recognize that this can have a very strong detrimental impact on that. I mean, certainly if I'm a student from one of these affected countries and I'm thinking to come to South Dakota or come to anywhere in the United States to pursue a degree, the fact that this executive order becomes basically the law of the land and I'm never allowed to enter the country, or if I get started here and then this becomes an overall ban, those students, I think, are probably going to think differently about how they make choices of entering post-secondary in our country. I also think that, you know, on top of the 70 students that I've referenced earlier, We have about 1,700 international students who were enrolled in our system in the fall of 2016. And so I think those types of students also begin to think, all right, so it started with seven countries. Could that expand to 20 or to a point where we don't allow anyone into the country to pursue educational opportunities? And so I know that our international coordinators are certainly very concerned about how they're working with students right now who they're trying to recruit to come and provide, I think, that good, diverse learning experience that we've tried to really reinforce within the Regional system.
What kind of recruitment do the universities do for international students?
It takes a couple of different forms. Certainly, probably the one that has the biggest impact is our exchange programs. Mm-hmm. With those eventually sometimes transitioning into students who then want to become degree-seeking. And so they're not really working under the agreement anymore. They're coming, paying the 150% of tuition, similar to what a non-resident student would do. In other fashions, our graduate programs have gotten very aggressive at trying to recruit international students, working with the universities or countries where we do have good memorandums of understanding and agreement. And once they've had good experiences here, then we tend to begin to foster a very good pipeline of students who come to the state. And then I think our long-term goal is not that different from what we do with non-resident students, say from Nebraska or Iowa or Minnesota, to recruit very talented individuals to come, get their degree with the goal of potentially staying in South Dakota, which we've seen some good evidence of that.
Okay, so just to be clear, the exchange program is just what, a semester or so, or a year?
Tends to be a semester and sometimes a year, but they are non-degree seeking. That is not the intent of those students to finish a degree at the institution that they attend.
And they just come for the experience and then they go back and the credits transfer and that kind of thing, right?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So whether it's a student that we've brought in from another country or having our students go to those institutions, they are signing up for credits at their home campus, and then they're looking for equivalencies at those other institutions, and then those come back. So a student is not put behind in their academic pursuits by participating in an exchange program at all.
Okay. And how does South Dakota and the numbers that we have for international students and the staff, how does that compare to other colleges and universities across the country?
I think we are maybe a little bit lower in those overall percentages. Some of that is what we've seen here more recently. The last decade, as we've expanded our graduate program significantly, that has also increased the number of international faculty that we have as we recruit some of the best scientists and faculty members from around the world, not just in the United States. And I think that then has transitioned into having more international students want to enroll as undergraduates with the goal of then getting into some of our graduate programs as well. And so we've seen a pretty sizable increase, almost doubling the number of international students that we've had over the last 5 to 7 years.
And talk a little bit about some of the programs and where students here from the universities have plans to travel abroad, and is there concern or anything like that?
We
especially
had,
for classes and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the same type of fear that an international student from one of these countries has. I mean, if we have students who are at those in those countries engaged in an exchange program, then I think those countries may kind of present the same type of order that President Trump had done. And so I think it certainly does begin to ask, have a student question whether or not, all right, as this kind of overall uncertainty continues to happen, is this a good decision for me to make about what I want to do next fall or next spring? And so I'm hopeful that it doesn't decrease the overall numbers of exchange students that we have, because I think our board for a good number of years now has really been excited about the growth that we've had in our exchange programs, similar to internships and cooperative experiences that students can take advantage of. You know, the opportunity to go overseas and engage with people that, you know, in their careers they may be doing international business with is certainly one of those things that I know businesses in South Dakota should be seeking of the graduates that we produce.
And what kind of reaction and what kind of teaching opportunity is this providing on the college campuses in South Dakota?
We haven't seen any, I mean, certainly not the type of reaction that you're seeing at institutions around the country. I know that our campuses each send out notifications, just kind of pointing them to the right person who to talk to, and that they're there to provide assistance as needed. But I also think that this creates a very good, you know, opportunity in a number of our classes about kind of, you know, international diplomacy, the ways in which public policy are formulated and how different branches utilize their authority and the extent that those authorities can be upheld. And so it's certainly serving not only in our classrooms, but I would say high school classrooms around the state right now. It's very good points of discussion about where really does the ultimate authority on some of these critical issues really reside. And I think the courts are going to begin to kind of work some of those things out here in the coming weeks.
Well, and a three-judge panel is hearing arguments today about what's happening with the executive order. And so, I mean, you have the legal side. You have, I mean, you have all of these different things. Do you anticipate bringing in speakers, bringing in, or that's really not a Board of Regents decision to make? It's up to each individual university.
Ultimately, it does kind of get positioned at the institutions themselves. Mm-hmm. The board normally isn't responsible for identifying speakers or asking campuses to take up different topics. A lot of times these are really coordinated through our student organizations. You know, they pay a general activity fee, and some of those fee dollars are allocated back out to them to engage in these type of discussions and making sure that the right speakers from both sides of the aisle are coming and giving people perspective and forcing them to really think about kind of different worldview perspectives. So, I mean, the board does have a policy about ways in which speakers must go through a process of being vetted before they come on campuses to speak so that everybody is treated equally. But beyond that, we ask that the campuses manage that process internally, and they've tended to do a pretty good job of doing that.
Okay. Paul Terman, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on In the Moment. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Kara.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland, sitting in today for Lori Walsh. And with so many misconceptions and fears swirling around immigration in America, we pause now to just consider the facts. Carrie Lee Skogberg Eastman is the author of Immigration, Examining the Facts, and she joins us now to talk about who's coming to America and what they actually do when they get here. Carrie, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. I appreciate being invited.
So let's start about who can come to America and how do they get here?
Well, there are basically four legal ways that people can come to the United States and receive legal status. So you can be a legal immigrant through an employer-sponsored visa, through family-sponsored visas, through professional or diversity visas, of which there are only 50,000 available, and those are designated for countries that have typically been underrepresented. Or you can obtain legal status as a refugee or asylum seeker. So if you fit in one of those categories, you can obtain legal status here in the United States. If you do not, then there is not a legal path in order to come into this country.
Okay, so we, though, are a nation of immigrants. And so how do American newcomers just start getting suspicious of other newcomers?
Well, unfortunately, since our nation's beginnings, we've had a long history of not necessarily being welcoming to newcomers or immigrants who have arrived on our shores. There is a misperception or a notion that we've always been a very open and welcoming country to immigrants as long as they come the right way, right, and stand in line. But unfortunately, that's not true. We have decades and over a century, or centuries rather, of history that show discrimination toward the Irish, for example, after the potato famine. Signs were posted across the eastern seaboard, particularly in New York, that said Irish need not apply because they were considered undesirables. We had discrimination against Southern and Eastern Europeans, Africans, Germans, Jews, Catholics, Sicilians, Asians, Chinese and Japanese were particularly largely discriminated against in the late 1800s. And more recently, we've seen that discrimination among Mexican populations, against Muslims. So we have a long history of not necessarily welcoming the newcomer. And even in the early history of the United States, the Know Nothing Party was established to limit the ability of new immigrants to even vote and make decisions because they weren't considered smart enough or equal enough in the society in order to make those important decisions.
Let's go back just a little bit to the stand-in-line way of immigrating into the United States. Mm-hmm. You have the proper documentation and all of that, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you decide that this is where you want to go. So then transition then to, and explain what's happening for the perception anyway of the illegal way and what's the difference?
Right. Well, I think what a lot of people don't understand is that the vast, vast majority of those who come into this country without proper documentation would never qualify under our legal measures to come into the United States with a proper documentation. Either they don't have family already existing in the United States who would sponsor their visa, they don't have an employer who already has made some contact and is willing to file the paperwork and pay the fees that are associated with those employer-sponsored visas. They may not qualify for refugee or asylum status, and they wouldn't necessarily qualify for the diversity visas. And again, because there are so few of those available, they are primarily directed toward the countries that have been underrepresented. So if you look at the history of our undocumented migrants in this country, they have been traditionally from Mexico, working people who have come here to seek out opportunities in agricultural sectors and construction, service sectors of our society. But many of those people, because they would never qualify for a legal means of coming, have made the choice to come without the proper documentation. And I think it's really important also to consider the push and pull factors that have brought them here. That it isn't just the legal and illegal issue. It's the fact that there are employers on this side of the border that are willing to hire those people and employ them. The Great Recession actually proved to our country that without those jobs available, the migration slowed dramatically. So from 2009 onward, the numbers of unauthorized immigrants in the United States, particularly from Mexico, began to decline and has declined ever since. We saw a greater out-migration among Mexicans back to Mexico during those years than we did in-migration from Mexico into the United States. So there are push-pull factors at play, and there are many other factors that drive that economic necessity, poverty, violence, other problems in the countries, particularly just south of us, Mexico and Central America, that have created the immigration issues we see today. One other issue I'd like to bring up related to that is the changing nature of migration, where we used to see primarily workers coming in through the border in Arizona. We now see a large majority of our migrant population coming in through southern Texas. And unfortunately, they are classified as illegal immigrants or undocumented persons, when in fact, a large majority of those who are coming now through Texas are not immigrants at all. They are asylum seekers. So their purpose in coming is to flee the incredible violence that is taking place right now as the result of gang activity in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And in those three countries, life has become so unbearable and families have become targets for these gang members who have demanded either induction into the gangs, or the children are literally being shot in the street or shot in front of their family members. The families have said, we have no other choice. We have to leave, or we have to send our children out of here in order to ensure that they stay alive. So those people, instead of running away from Border Patrol, as is often the perception and the way this issue is presented to the American public, the majority are running to Border Patrol asking to seek asylum. And legally, they are to be treated differently than someone who crosses the border simply without documentation. They are to be given the opportunity to present their asylum case in a court and to have that case heard.
So you have asylum seekers, you have legal immigration, you have the what is considered, you know, crossing the border illegally, and then you also have refugees.
We have refugees as well, yes.
And how does that all work, and how can the average American tell the difference?
It's not easy, because it often gets lumped together in the way that it's talked about by politicians or by media personalities. But I think just recognizing that there are different standards and different numerical limits on these groups that guide our policies is really important in coming up with the direction forward, right? And in working together to find the best way that we can move forward and honor the humanity of all the groups concerned, including U.S. citizens. So refugees, for example, are admitted on the basis of a ceiling that's established by law between the president and Congress. So the president needs to present his numbers of his estimated admission ceiling to Congress, and that working between the two of them, they establish what that ceiling will be for the subsequent fiscal year. And those are the limits then on the number of refugees that are admitted. That in turn is broken down to different parts of the world, so that not all refugees are coming from one area. In fact, they are limited. For example, in 2016, there were 27,000 from Africa, and that was the limit. From Europe and Central Asia, 4,000. And so you can look at the list of where they come from and how many are allowed from each area, and those numbers then cannot surpass the ceiling that has been established. Asylum seekers, on the other hand, are not granted. Asylum is not granted on the basis of any numerical limits. There's not a limit on who can apply or how many can apply for asylum, but it's a very small number that of asylum seekers that are actually granted asylum. In 2014, just over 23,500 out of all those who applied. So those numbers are relatively small, especially in the perspective of how many are coming and applying or seeking to apply for asylum.
And so how is the makeup of immigrants in our country shifting today?
Yeah, that's a great question. The primary immigrant population, again, used to come primarily from Mexico and some from Central America, but that now looks very different. And the primary country of origin for immigrants as of 2014 was India, followed by China, and Mexico was in third place. Canada was fourth. So we are seeing a lot more immigrants from Asia, a lot more immigrants employed in IT, high-tech sectors, very educated immigrants from various parts of the world. So the notion or the misperception, perhaps, that the majority of our immigrants are poor people coming to look for a better life in America isn't necessarily the case. We are attracting, since 1965, our immigration laws have changed in order to encourage both family reunification and also high-skilled or specialized skills among the immigrants who are brought here.
So when you were listening during the election cycle, some of the rhetoric that was spoken, what was your reaction?
A lot of disgust.
You wrote the book, right?
I wrote the book. I think just disgust, not over necessarily people's opinions, but over the fact that there were so many misrepresentations of immigration that were given through political avenues. Just one example is the notion that immigrants are criminals. That is absolutely, first of all, you never stereotype an entire group of people and say that all of them are rapists and criminals. And I suppose if you were a good people, that was a quote from then candidate Trump. But the problem with that is that decades and decades and decades of studies have looked at this issue, and all of them have proven that immigrants are actually less likely to commit crimes, particularly violent crimes and property crimes, than native-born citizens. So it is a completely disproven notion that immigrants are criminals, yet when that type of rhetoric is fed through media sources and news stories and repeated by politicians, the public naturally begins to fear the other, right? And consider that immigrants are somehow something to be feared. There's a cultural anthropologist by the name of Olivia Ruiz Marujo, who talks about the difference between viewing immigrants at risk and viewing immigrants as risk. And that type of rhetoric encourages the public to see them as risk instead of recognizing, again, those push and pull factors that bring them here and recognize the vulnerabilities under which many of them come, whether they come legally or without authorization.
So talk a little bit then about the consequences of the executive order.
The consequences are playing out, right? I'm still learning, as the rest of us are, about what that may look like. I can speak to this fact. Under Trump's plan or proposal, the refugee ceiling, as an example, would drop from what is currently, in 2016, that ceiling was set at 85,000, and President Obama hoped to increase that to 110,000 per year. Again, focusing on those who are most in need and focusing on Syrian refugees. So, of course, with these executive orders, Syrian refugees would not be allowed into the United States, and that overall ceiling would drop to 50,000, a number that we haven't seen, I believe, since the early 1990s, definitely not since 2008 when I had begun looking at the numbers.
Okay. And so some of the unintended consequences, especially border control, let's just talk border control. And I think when people think border control, they're thinking, you know, U.S. and Mexico.
Right.
And so, you know, I've heard people say it's not necessarily a wall that's needed. It's more border control officers. It's better technology. It's that kind of thing. So are there consequences and part of that debate that we need a better understanding and more facts on?
Absolutely. And this is something that is really essential for the American public to understand. I think definitely all Americans want to have control over our borders, because none of us want terrorists to have the ability, or undesirable criminals or drug dealers, whatever, to be able to come into our country. So definitely there need to be controls on the border. But in looking at the way that this has been approached historically, we can learn a lot. In the mid-1980s and up until the early 1990s, there had been a very predictable pattern of migration, particularly from Mexico. The majority came from Mexico, but it was circular migration, and it was among workers who would come as target wage earners and come for a specified period of time, whether it was an agricultural season or an employment contract, whatever that may be. But when that period of time ended, they would return home to Mexico. And researchers have studied this and verified that it was a very predictable pattern that that was well established and circular in nature. Starting in basically the early to mid-1990s, we began to fortify the border with drastically increased numbers of Border Patrol officers and the building of fences along the primary crossing corridors, which were San Diego-Tijuana and El Paso-Ciudad Juarez. As we did that, we found some very unintended consequences. So what happens when you blow up a balloon and you squeeze one end? Mm-hmm. The other end inflates, right? And if you squeeze both ends at the same time, the middle inflates. So officials at the time said that the reasons behind this fortification of the border were to discourage unauthorized immigration or illegal immigration, because no one would want to make this journey through the desolate and vast inhospitable lands of the desert in southern Arizona or northern Sonora, Mexico. But it became apparent very quickly that that was not the case. It did, in fact, rechannel the flow of migrants through those areas, which traditionally had not seen any unauthorized migration. And what happened was the death rate among those migrants began to rise exponentially. Most Americans don't realize, when they hear about the crisis on the border, they think of numbers. They don't realize, A, that the numbers of people crossing the border and the apprehension levels, which are used to measure the illegal immigration, are at their lowest point now that they've been since the 1970s. In spite of that fact, and because it's been declining for at least 9 years, but in spite of that fact, there is a greater likelihood of death among those who attempt the journey today than there ever has been in history, because people are forced away from roads and from water sources, and the militarization or the fortification of the border that has taken place have forced them into more and more remote areas. It has not discouraged the migration in and of itself, or at least not entirely. It can be argued validly that definitely the fortification of the border has had an effect on the numbers and flows of migrants. However, it also has not stopped that flow, but rather rechanneled it into areas that are more dangerous and more likely to result in migrants losing their lives. And just to illustrate that fact, the Pima County Medical Examiner's Office, which is the office charged with handling the bodies of migrants who are found in the southern Arizona desert, at one point had to bring in a refrigerated truck to hold the bodies of all those migrants that had been found, because they could not keep up with the pace of the numbers that were coming in. Over 6,000 people have lost their lives on our southern border since 2000.
Why the need to cross illegally when there's a process to come legally?
Well, again, it goes back to the fact that the vast majority of those who try to enter without legal documentation would not qualify for a legal visa. They don't have a family member, and they don't have an employer sponsor. I've heard stories about those who feel that their only hope in, for example, saving the life of a family member who needed medical care was to come northward to find a job that could pay them enough that they would be able to send that money back home, etc. But I think it's really important, as we move forward as a nation, that our politicians understand there are solutions and there are positive steps that we can take to eliminate the vast majority of that population that comes without documentation. If we examine together the push and pull factors that bring people here and identify that there are areas in employment sectors where that immigrant labor is needed, creating legal means for those people to come on a program that might be similar to a guest worker program or some type of migration system that is not permanent, but rather one that encourages people and allows them to return back home, would eliminate the need for Border Patrol to be chasing workers through the desert or chasing people through the desert who don't pose an imminent threat to our society. And at the time that I was doing my research in southern Arizona, Border Patrol told me that 70 to 75% of the people that they apprehended were workers coming northward looking for work in the United States. So if you take that percentage off of the border and allow them to come through legal means or create a legal worker system, it allows the Border Patrol that are in place, which has doubled, by the way, in less than 20 years, we've doubled the number of Border Patrol officers on the border. But it allows those who are there to actually be able to catch and go after the people that we truly do not want in our society, who are a danger to the American public. So, I think that's a consideration that we need to make, and in the dialogue that we have about this issue, and in the way that we talk about immigration and immigrants, we have to recognize that it's not just a one-way street, that there are people on the side of the border that are encouraging that migration as well. And so how do we deal with those factors in order to allow people to come with dignity and with legal means?
And talk a little bit about the historical precedent of executive orders about this issue.
I guess I can't speak to that extensively. I'm not an expert in that area, but certainly this is an unprecedented time in terms of the President of the United States establishing such incredible restrictions on the number and nature of people who are allowed into the United States as immigrants. And it's created great concern around the world about how that might be expanded and who might be included in the next round of executive actions. The major argument right now is that the executive actions are based more on religion and a religious basis than they are on the danger to national security, because of the lack of evidence of the people who are being banned from the United States, having been a part of any terrorist attack on our soil. So that's something the Supreme Court will have to work out, and we'll watch, I guess, as that process continues.
And what's the dialogue that we need to be having right now?
First and foremost, I think the dialogue that we absolutely have to have and insist that our politicians have is a dialogue of respect that keeps the human at the center of this issue. I think so often this issue has become bifurcated and it's become polarized, and people have felt like they needed to stand on one side or the other and that there was no middle ground. We won't make any progress as a nation if we continue on that track. We have to talk to one another and respect each other's opinions. National security is a valid issue, and we absolutely have to address that with our immigration policies. It's also critical that we address the fact that our current system is broken. For the past 11 years, as I've been doing research on this topic, people on all sides and with all kinds of views on the issue, from the Minuteman Civil Defense Corps to the Humane Borders Volunteers, all said our system is broken. It has to be reformed. And so when reform was very close and very likely, it seemed, in 2013, there were finally people sitting down on both sides of the aisle, sitting down together and talking about how we can move forward and make this work. It seems that we've regressed now, and we have to get to a point where we're able to talk to one another respectfully, with dignity and with dialogue that upholds the value of all human beings at the center of this argument, whether that be citizens of the United States or the migrants or the immigrants or the refugees or the asylum seekers that are affected by our policies.
Okay, Carrie, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on the program today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Carrie Skoberg Eastman is an immigration scholar and author of the reference book Immigration: Examining the Facts. And we're in the moment here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Kara Hetland, in today for Lori Walsh. And joining me now is founder and CEO of the Center for Education Reform, Jeannie Allen. She joins us now from Capitol Hill. Jeannie, thanks for taking time out of your day today and being with us in the moment.
My pleasure, Kara. Thank you.
So you spent some time working in the Department of Education, and so we're taking this time right now. Is there, what, seven states that do not have what are considered charter schools? And I'm wondering if you could just kind of help us understand what a charter school is.
Absolutely. Yes, I've been in the department, but more importantly, spent the last nearly 25 years focused on states and working with policymakers, parents, and educators at all levels. Through our organization to try to help them bring new and better opportunities to students. Charter schools, Kara, simply put, are public schools that are accountable for results, but free from most rules and regulations, save for health, safety, discrimination, et cetera, that tend to hamper progress in traditional schools. Teachers and parents, administrators have complained for so long that they are stuck and oftentimes conflicted by competing rules and regulations that tell them when to teach, how to teach, when to test. I mean, these are familiar themes to you all. And charter schools were created in 1991 as a way to rethink public education, to set a new course for having public schools, but those that would be offered diverse programs and learning opportunities, open by choice and held accountable for results. And so, you know, in the last 25 plus years, 26 years, we've seen a tremendous surge in achievement among students wherever there are charters, and not just in the charter schools, but in traditional schools themselves. South Dakota is one of the last seven states we'd like to call you that are the holdouts, and we'd love to see you join the fold and do something even different and new with a charter law.
Why are there holdouts? What's the argument?
Well, yeah, so you know, there's lots of arguments these days against charter schools, all of them deeply flawed, and we just released a publication called Just the Facts, which people can find at our website, edreform.com. But the reason South Dakota and Montana and Kentucky and states like it and North Dakota have held out, I truly believe, is because there is an impression and some conventional wisdom that in rural states, it's hard to create options, and so people would not have schools to choose from. And so while that's absolutely, while the fact that rural communities are a challenge, that's absolutely a fact, the reality is that what a charter school law does is it allows people closest to kids to decide exactly how they're going to provide for new kinds of education. You might do it through an existing school. You might do schools within schools. You might take those kids who get on a bus 60 miles away every day, which I know happens in your state, and give them kind of a satellite campus of another school. So wherever you go, there are ways and opportunities to truly make charter schooling possible for all kids, no matter what their community.
So, Jeannie, are charter schools more parent-driven, a parent wanting something specific for their child?
Well, about a third of the charter schools in the country, there's over 7,000 now, were started by parents, about a third started by educators, and a third by different civic and organizational groups. The point is, it's truly grassroots and democracy in action. It's people who may have not been active in their previous school, but have found ways and opportunities to get together and hire the right people and cast a vision for what exists. There are back-to-basics charter schools. There are schools that are small experiential learning. There are arts-based. There are those that are focused on science, engineering, and math. So no matter what you look at, they are more parent-driven in the sense that a parent has to choose to go there. If they're happy where they are, they stay where they are. And if they're not, they can move, and the money that is allocated for their education follows them to that school of their choice.
And how do you know that a charter school would be better than a big, wide-reaching public education, traditional speaking?
Sure. You know, this is where we talk about a really important word that families know about on a daily basis, which is fit. Yeah, does it fit my child? I mean, we make decisions every day about whether or not we have the right fit. Do we have the right community? Do we have the right church? Are we in the right program in a particular school? Is our doctor the right fit? I mean, parents struggle with this every day, and there's not one manual that comes down from on high or from the government saying, this is how you make those choices. Parents, when given the option, know how to make choices. Over 3 million parents have been making those choices across the country, and the vast majority of those parents are not folks who already had those options. And so parents that are more affluent can afford to move to better community schools. They can buy private education. In a rural area, a rural state like South Dakota, you tend to have to stick with what you have. And that doesn't give a lot of incentive to people to do things very differently when you've got a captive clientele. So there's an opportunity through charter schooling for diversity of offerings. Teachers begin to think and do things very differently because the culture is not set by policies that's long been in place at the state and the school district level. And so there are opportunities to diversify and provide options and meet the needs of kids as opposed to kids having to fit in a one-size-fits-all school system.
You talked a little bit about the rural school, the rural states, I guess. And, I mean, you need a student body to make it successful and financially viable, correct?
That's right. And you'd be surprised how that could work. So first of all, parents in rural states are where they are by and large because that's where the people are, right? Mm-hmm. And what drives people to more distant communities is the economics or the opportunity, so opportunity for jobs or the ability to live better. And rural communities don't tend to have a lot of business, obviously. They don't put schools in them because the schools have been centralized. But imagine if you had a school in a more distant community that might be closer to where someone has a business, a farm. Maybe it's closer to where someone's family grew up. Imagine if that school now was wired and had access to the internet, maybe was connected to the major school district down the road. And what happens when you actually have schools is communities build around them. And so it may not be for everyone, but once you begin to create the law that allows people to think differently about where you provide for schooling, you tend to see lots of creativity. There are rural communities in Colorado, in Minnesota. Those are two of the first laws. In California, there are schools in places where there's nothing else around for 60 miles where there was never a school before. And a school was built up in these communities out like an hour east of Sacramento, for example, because all these families were putting their babies on the bus to go an hour every day. And by doing that, people began to stay home and they telecommuted to work, or they created businesses that they weren't able to create before because they were too busy worrying about their kids an hour away or rushing to a meeting an hour away. So humans, and of course mm-hmm. Americans, are incredibly mobile. De Tocqueville wrote about this, you know, some 200 years ago. We're very mobile and we're very creative. But if you don't give people the chance to be creative, you won't get new and different kinds of schooling opportunities.
So we need the law first that allows us to think differently, or do we need the drive and the push for the law to be written?
No, you need the law. You need the drive and the push to get the law written. We've worked with people in South Dakota years ago, and we're told the policymakers weren't interested, sadly. But a law that allows, for example, a university to be the authorizer with charter schooling, there needs to be someone who agrees to be the boss in the place that through which applications come and through which schools are monitored for, you know, state and federal requirements. We're very big fans of universities. Universities are in the education business. They already have all the built-in business structure. But your law would have to say something like, you know, the state of South Dakota adopts the chance for charters to open, and this is how they'll start, and this is who can start one, and be very, very loose on what it looks like, and allow 1,000 flowers to bloom. That's how the best laws in the country started. Look, there's no harm in doing it. If you create a law and nobody does it, what's the fear, right? So many school districts and superintendents, again, particularly in rural communities, think, well, how is that going to work? Where are you going to get the money from? Well, the money allocated for education is allocated for every individual student to get educated. If your child is not being educated, you should have access to those funds to be able to take them, in this case, to another public school, a charter school, that might open to serve those needs. And so money follows kids, and superintendents and school districts figure out how to manage the fluctuations that may come from having a dynamic marketplace of schools. They don't think they can, but again, we have 25, 26, going on 26 years of experience. They absolutely know how to manage fluctuations.
Okay, Jeannie Allen, I want to thank you for taking time and giving us a call and joining us on In the Moment today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Jeannie Allen is the founder and CEO of the Center for Education Reform, and we appreciate her time today and coming on In the Moment, a conversation that will continue here as Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos was confirmed by the Senate with a historic and unprecedented tie-breaking vote by the Vice President.